Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is Greg Dyke, former Director General of the BBC, but of course, so much more than that. Former Chair of the FA, ran LWT, ITV Sport, has just worked in so many different areas of broadcasting and British life at a leadership level, and as a result, has a unique perspective, not just on what's happening with the BBC at the moment, but just on leadership and broadcasting and the public's relationship with the BBC and with streaming and all sorts of other things. This is just a phenomenal, wide-ranging conversation with someone who's been so influential in our lives. When you think of the TV we watch, and also as a football fan, a fair bit about football and Brian Clough and a whole load of other things, his beloved Brentford and Manchester United as well. Before I play you this wonderful interview, to let you know that my next guests at the live shows are as follows. On Monday the 20th of March, my guest is Krishnan Gurumurthy. On Monday the 3rd of April, my guest is Ruth Davidson. Now, that will just be a few days after the SNP have chosen their new leader. So a perfect time to be talking to the former leader of the Scottish Conservatives. On the 17th of April, one of the most charismatic politicians in the country, Jess Phillips, always a phenomenal night with Jess. On Monday the 22nd of May, the definition of a big beast, of a political heavyweight, David Blunkett. When you think of what a fascinating life he's led, that'd be a very special evening. And on Monday the 5th of June, former Conservative Chancellor Philip Hammond. Obviously by that point we will understand more about the budget that came out just a few days ago, and he's a man who gives very few interviews. So I shall stop this preamble and leave you in the capable hands of Greg Dyke. Delighted to be joined by the one and only Greg Dyke. Greg, I mean, you must have been watching this last week, fortnight unfold, with a mixture of horror, fascination. I mean, what's your overall analysis of what's happened and how it could have been avoided?
Well, the rules have been changed since I was there, and I think the new rule, so the BBC, and I think the new rule is not workable. And they've tried, this is the first test of it, really, and it's failed miserably. And they're now going to have to review it. I mean, I've deliberately, in the 20 years since I left the BBC, nearly 20 years, I'm deliberately not critical of the leadership of the BBC because I know it's a tough job. But on this occasion, it seemed so absurd. And the ramifications were quite profound. And the one that worried me was it looked like the BBC had folded to pressure from a Conservative government. And the real thing about the BBC is it shouldn't be seen to fold to any pressure from either side.
Obviously, the BBC has political pressure from left, right and centre, and there are friends, critical friends and enemies of the BBC who will periodically attack it, sometimes because they genuinely think it's made a wrong decision, other times because they have an agenda and they want to defund it, abolish it, privatise it, whatever, to suit whatever their individual political cause of the day is. The BBC's come through a period of Brexit and Corbyn where that was really Scottish independence, where it felt like every political party was attacking it. But there's a difference between that, I guess, and a sense that there is almost a crony culture at the top of it. I mean, do you think some of those criticisms are fair? That actually Tim Davies, a guy who stood for election for the Tory party.
Well, no, I don't think that's fair. I think the problem at the weekend was the perception, not necessarily the reality. I don't necessarily think they folded to the pressure from government. I think they'd introduced new rules themselves and tried to apply them. And what they discovered is their new rules don't work.
When you were Director General, it was, I think I'm right in saying, pre-social media.
Yeah, really.
How would you have dealt with stars like Gary Lineker or any BBC star in a similar position to his, i.e. a non-news broadcaster, in an era like this of Twitter and Facebook?
I think we'd have put out a statement saying that Gary Lineker is basically a football presenter and he's entitled to his own views. They don't happen to be the views of the BBC. We don't have views on things like that. Now, if Gary Lineker had started using his football programme to promote those views, then we'd have come down pretty hard. But of course, that wasn't the case. And that's not the case with social media. So it is tougher. But I think the BBC is going to realise that, on so many issues. I mean, the example I've used, because she's a mate of mine, is Sarah Lancashire. Say Happy Valley you'd been the last week of Happy Valley and Sarah Lancashire had said something outrageous politically. Were they going to pull Happy Valley? I mean, the truth is, people are going to have opinions and you don't always like them and you don't always want them, but that's the case. Now, in terms of the BBC has managed to keep that strict position on news and current affairs over the years. When I was there, we fired the editor of the Today programme for something he wrote, which was the right decision because he was the editor of the Today programme. And what you couldn't do is when I have people coming on the Today programme saying, we know what your editor thinks, so most of it. So that it seems to me that news and current affairs, you've got to keep separate. But no one's going to go on Match of the Day and start complaining about Gary's views on anything other than football.
So do you think it'd be easy for the BBC to then say, apart from news presenters, anyone involved with the BBC, as long as what they say doesn't breach hate speech legislation or something like that, you can actually just say what you like?
Yeah, I think that's where they might end up. That's not where they are at the moment, but they've introduced this sort of vague concept that people that are important to the BBC or important to the perception of the BBC. Well, that could be almost anybody. And I think that's the problem they've got. But of course, what happened over the weekend was they suddenly realised that they were, and I pay credit to Tim, and on he got them out of it on Monday, because, you know, the worst thing would be to double down and make it worse, because, you know, they had basically their sports staff had told them, we're not doing this.
Did you watch Premier League highlights on Saturday or Sunday night?
No, luckily I was at a concert somewhere, so I didn't, which was, I think, just as well. I see some Tory MPs enjoyed it, but that's because they don't know anything about football anyway.
I mean, it was a surreal the main thing you missed really was the commentators, because it made you realise, even as someone who watches football all the time, turns out I don't know who half of these players are.
Well, I know. Well, I'm a Manchester United and Brentford fan, but I'm basically a Brentford fan. And I was at Brentford last night when we played at Southampton, and I didn't have a programme and I couldn't, their screens aren't clear enough for you to see who's playing. And even I go and watch them every other week, and I didn't know who half the players were.
It was a great result last night for just on Brentford. I mean, we're talking at a time when the England squad's about to be announced. Do you think Ivan Toney should be included?
Well, he's got this problem of gambling, hasn't he, that is going to come up quite soon. And I can't see him being in the England squad at the moment. Do I think other occasions? Yes, I think there are players who play in clubs like Brentford. And it's not only Toney who should get closer to the squad. Toney isn't going to be in the squad today. I mean, I'd be amazed.
Morgan Gibbs-White at Nottingham Forest?
Yeah, I don't know. Are you a Forest supporter? Yeah, you
I
see.
I am, yeah. Of course I am.
Well, there's that kid on the wing. Is it Johnson?
Oh, Brennan. Yeah, but he's Welsh, sadly.
Yeah, we tried to sign him. Brentford tried to sign him when you were still in the Division 1.
Well, he wanted to stay at a big club, didn't he?
Well, yes. So he'll leave at some time.
I mean, obviously, you've held various posts in football as well, on the boards of Brentford, Manchester United, and obviously on the broadcasting side as well, and at the FA. People talk about football losing its soul and it moving away from its working class roots. And I think people have conflicting experiences about this. You know, you go to some modern stadiums and actually it's a pleasure to visit. You're not herded around like cattle. On the other hand, trying to watch Premier League football on telly, if you haven't got Sky, you know, it's so expensive to try and watch it. What is that a problem, do you think, for the national game and our national identity? And is there anything that effectively the government could do to ensure that some Premier League games are free to air?
What worries me more is not that about football, is that increasingly professional football in this country is increasingly owned by, run by, played by people who are not British. I have no problem with having some great players come and play in this country, but I mean, that's not what's happening. I mean, you go down to even lower divisions now and they're bringing in foreign players because they're cheaper than British players. And I think that isn't good for, you know, if you're a kid who goes into football, basically you start at, you know, 7, 8 now, don't you, at a club, you go right the way through. And there's no incentive for that club really to play you. And I think that's a much bigger problem in English football, that there's no route through. And I saw some amazing figures when I was at the FA, which showed something like 90-odd% of players at professional clubs at the age of 16 are out of football altogether by the time they're 20. And, you know, it's just too difficult. It's just so much easier to sign people from other countries. Now, I was not a Brexiteer in any way at all, except I thought that was the one opportunity that allowed governments to say, no, you've now got to restrict the number of foreign players you bring into this country. And I think they should do that.
Brexit was one of those areas that, again, was very difficult for the BBC, and it found itself in the middle of a debate that it hadn't itself wanted. And there are still people on the Remain side that talk about impartiality and fake news and claims that weren't effectively rebutted. I mean, there must have been a part of you that, I don't know, whether you thought actually that it would have been a great time to be a director of general of the BBC at a time like that. Maybe it made you want to get back in there. Was there also part of you that thought, thank God I'm not in charge of the organisation at a time like that?
It was difficult, I think, for the BBC. And personally, I didn't like the way they covered it particularly. But then I'm not a Brexiteer. I mean, if the vote had gone the other way by 1 or 2%, the BBC would have got so much flack from the Brexiteers, saying you're the reason we didn't win and all the rest of it. I think the BBC, it's a difficult period for the BBC. And it's partly a difficult period because the government of the day, I mean, we've had some pretty odd people as culture secretary, and who were quite hostile to the BBC, which wasn't the case when I was there.
And just looking from afar, I mean, I don't know whether there's a WhatsApp group of former director generals, whether it's like prime ministers who periodically ask each other's advice. I mean, has Tim Davie ever been in touch and asked for advice?
We did have a dinner to celebrate the 100th anniversary of all the sort of, all bar one, I think, of the living director generals. And I think the one thing we all agreed on was that it's quite a tough job. And Tim seemed to think that so far he'd escaped that. Well, that disappeared last week, didn't it?
It did, yeah. I mean, I just wonder about the future of the BBC. And without sounding like sort of like policy speak, but how does the BBC make the case for itself going forward after this? Like, do you think it has to effectively have a new contract with the public? Because, you know, periodically we go through, each generation seems to have a debate about the BBC and not just its funding model, but how relevant it is, how big it is, the things that it should and shouldn't do. Do you have a view on whether the BBC is too big, too small, in effect, in the right position?
I think the BBC is being starved of finance, and I think that's quite serious. And that was Nadine Doris's decision, with backed by Boris Johnson, to freeze the licence fee, saying people couldn't afford it. I noticed they didn't freeze anything else they were involved in. No, I think Nadine Doris was a pretty... I'm not impressed by Nadine Doris in politics at all, but I thought she was a really odd choice to have as culture secretary. We're coming up to an election where I suspect the current government will lose. You can't be certain, but I suspect they'll lose. And the thing about the history of the BBC is oppositions quite like the BBC because they try to hold the government to account, and governments don't after a while. So you basically get a honeymoon period. So if there's a change of government next year, if I suspect the BBC gets an easier period for 1 or 2 years, and then whoever is the winner, I'm assuming it'll be a Labour government or a Labour coalition government, their term will come again to hate the BBC, just as it did under Tony Blair with Alistair Campbell.
Have you spoken to Alistair Campbell at all since those days?
I see him occasionally, and he still shouts out, "We were right," and I still shout, and I shout back, "Well, yes, Alistair, but you're the only person who, you and Tony, the only two who believe you didn't sex up the case for war. Now there's only you left." Oddly, I saw he put out a tweet over the weekend saying, "I don't believe this, but I agree with Greg Dyke on Gary Lineker," we would always, I suspect, agree on a range of things. I mean, again, that job, if you're in government, is a tough job because you're not a politician, but you are trying to control the media.
A tough job for you as well, though, because obviously you had a history of supporting the Labour Party, but anyway, you're Director General of the BBC at a time when Britain is going to war. You've run reports about, as you say, the dossier, and then yourself, Gavin Davies, Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell really get drawn into what becomes an almost personal battle between the four of you. And, you know, the annexes of the Hutton report make for fascinating reading, the letters that are being fired back and forth between the BBC and Downing Street. Personally, how difficult was that period for you?
I always thought, until Dr. Kelly killed himself, I always thought it was one of those stories that would be a big fuss and bing, and would in the end go away. And then Dr. Kelly killed himself, and they appointed, as they called him, the right judge, who then came out with a report that the public didn't believe. I mean, it's quite interesting. I remember talking to some Labour people at that time and said, what do we do? The report finds totally for us and no one believes it. Well, they didn't believe it because it didn't match the evidence he'd heard. I'm an optimist in life, so I always thought everything was going to be fine. So I was quite amazed to find myself out of my ear one day in time. You can never be sure of the governors of the BBC. You know, people have said over the years, the independence and the real scrutiny of the BBC comes from within the BBC, not from the governors.
And that moment when you leave, you may still remember the news reports of the BBC staff and journalists gathering in reception. You sort of leave to this hero's departure that very few director generals, if any, have ever had. I mean, in a way, was there a sense in that moment that it was bittersweet, that you wanted to keep doing the job, but actually far better to leave in that way? You'd have had to have left one day, but great to leave as a hero.
Well, the reaction of the staff that day, it was the only nice thing that happened on what was otherwise a pretty horrible day. I think when I look back, It wasn't about the issue that I was leaving over. It was about that we made... I mean, I followed John Burt, who was not loved by the staff. And I had a different philosophy to him. I think a lot of things John did were right, but he should have tried to get people on side. And my view of running organizations is you've got to get your staff on your side. And if you haven't, you're never going to succeed. So I'd spent, 4 years trying to get people to support, to explain what we were doing, why we were doing it, and get them on side. And I think they were on side. And I think what they were disappointed about when I left was that they thought it would just go back to being the old top-down organisation that it had always been.
And for you at that point, when you're someone who's, it feels like, has always had big jobs in broadcasting, football and media, at that point, do you think, oh my God, am I ever going to work again? Or do you think, you know what, I'll be fine, something will come along?
Well, of course, I never did work again as a chief executive, really. And I think that was as a direct result. If you upset the government of the day to that extent, it's quite hard. But I was in my late 50s by then. So it was time to do other things. And I've done a range of other things since then. Some I liked, some I didn't. I mean, when I look back on my favourite jobs in my life, the best one was to running London Weekend Television, which I loved. The BBC was a good job, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would, actually. But I wouldn't say that the chairing the FA was one of the most exciting, one of the most enjoyable moments of my life.
A lot was made at the time when you left of. I think maybe it was Gavin Jones that knew Alistair Campbell better than you did, but this idea that actually these people know each other. This isn't just government and the BBC. There is at least some sort of informal channel here that these people are actually quite fond of each other, and the pressure that it was putting effectively on friendships or almost friendships. I mean, was there a sense of sadness about that?
When I took over the BBC as Director General, I thought my job was to keep away from the politicians of the day, really. And I didn't think it was my job to constantly be with them and talk to them and try and... And by and large, that worked for 3 years. And then in the fourth year, of course, came the Iraq War. And I think Alistair never forgave me for writing... Tony Blair basically wrote to me and said he thought we were not being impartial. And I wrote... Basically wrote back and said, look, I'm sorry, you're not the judge of impartiality. You've got millions out on the streets and half your party in rebellion. You've got to leave that to us and not leave it to Alistair. And I think that's what upset Alistair greatly.
And do you have some sympathy for them? Because Andrew Gilligan, you think about the phrase sexed up. I mean, it's still, you go back over it. Did David Kelly ever actually say it? Andrew Gilligan then goes to work for Boris Johnson. People close to Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell might say, well, this is proof. This guy was basically a Tory and he saw an opportunity to have a go at a Labour government, and the BBC stood the story up, and actually there should have been a bit more rigour there, and all the problems come from that effectively initial misjudgment.
Yeah, there was a misjudgment in his wording. We never denied that. But by and large, if you go through our evidence to the Hutton inquiry, it's very clear that that Alistair Campbell sexed up the document. It's very clear. They changed the title, they changed parts of it, and the rest of it. They even, when I look back now, and I've forgotten it's gone, but I do think there was no doubt. They did what you employ PR people to do. You employ PR people to give you the best spin, and they gave them the best spin. But whether you should use that on documents coming from the Secret Service is a different matter, I think.
When you first got the job, obviously there were people in the Tory party saying, oh, this guy, he's donated money to the Labour Party, you've got a Labour government. I mean, in a way, there's sort of echoes of the things that Tim Davies been through. Does that give you a bit of sympathy for Tim Davies' position?
Well, of course, Gavin and I, who have both given money to the Labour Party and had supported the Labour Party earlier in our lives, we ended up with an enormous bust-up with a Labour government. Tim, so far, hasn't had an enormous bust up with the Tories. He's had an enormous bust up with the public this weekend. I have a lot of sympathy for Tim's position. I have a lot of sympathy for running. That's a very difficult job. And I think he's had attacks and criticism of the BBC in the last 5 years from the right of the Tory party, which I don't think people have seen of that level before. Hopefully that will go away. I mean, last week, I thought the Prime Minister should have taken his Home Secretary aside and said, tone down your language. No problem about the policy. He ain't got a problem about the policy, whether others have. No problem about the policy, but tone down your language. And I think there's a thing about the right of the Conservative Party whose language is pretty unattractive in this. And that's, of course, what Gary was talking about.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And how hard is it to be? I mean, obviously, journalists go through this all the time, and people expect that journalists will have opinions of their own, and they're perfectly capable of being impartial. But when you are the director general of the BBC specifically, and you have your own political allegiances and they are known, how hard is it to direct an organisation that big and that important, and effectively keep your own politics out of it?
I didn't find that difficult, actually. I didn't find that difficult at all. Your job is to try to understand the issues and be impartial about them, but to explain them. Now, sometimes in explaining them, you might be seen to be quite hostile. But I think they're only trying to explain. I mean, remember, under governments inevitably use spin to try to get their view across. And it's the job of the BBC and other broadcasters and other journalists to question that and to say, no, hang on, this isn't right. We don't agree with that. That doesn't make you opposed to them or anti them or pro them. You're just trying to do a job.
Obviously, you had some time at the FA, and the England job used to be called an impossible job. But I wonder if Director General of the BBC is similarly impossible. You're in charge of something that, in a new sense, is unique globally, but also is a sprawling regional presence and really, in a way, the number one nurturer of broadcasting talent in the UK. You must have so many competing priorities at any one point. I mean, it must be the closest thing to being Prime Minister.
Well, I would say you go in on a Monday and you think, oh, it looks quite a nice week. And by Wednesday, something's happened that you've never heard of in Wales or something, and the whole thing's gone kaput. It's only how you deal with those things, isn't it? And if I look back on Dr. Kelly, we could have dealt with it better. Although I'm not sure it would have made much difference. I mean, I think from the moment Dr. Kelly killed him. I mean, if you ever go back and look at those pictures of Tony Blair getting off the plane when he's learnt that Dr. Kelly's been found dead, and he looks ashen-faced, and he knew the problems he was in. Because the one part of this, the whole story that we now know absolutely clearly, that where Tony Blair didn't tell the truth, because most of the time we didn't accuse him of lying, and I don't think he was, but was on when he said he had played no part in releasing Dr. Kelly's name, which was not true. And we now know it's not true. And I think that's what he was so worried about. He and Alistair Campbell had hung Dr. Kelly out there. And the result was he was dead.
When you think about your time as Director General, aside from Iraq, you know, when you first take over the job, at that point, what were the priorities for the BBC? I mean, this is pre-iPlayer at that point, pre-HDTV.
Well, we developed the iPlayer when I was there. We developed Freeview. I thought my job was to stop Rupert Murdoch controlling the broadcast media in the same way as he controlled the print media in this country. And I think that's why I was appointed. And I think we did that.
And did you ever meet Rupert Murdoch?
Yeah.
And what was he like?
Charming.
But did he ever talk to you about, you know, News Corp versus BBC type stuff?
No, but we talked about all sorts of issues. I've got to tell you, I think he was a genius in many ways. I think he was the outstanding owner of a journalistic organization of his time. It is quite interesting reading these reports from the States at the moment and Fox News, where he basically says it's not about, you know, he's quoted as saying it's not about red and blue, you know, Democrat or Republican. It's, or Republican or Democrat, for getting a better blue. It's not about that. It's about green, i.e., you report the news which is financially best for your organization. Now, that is a very sinister view of the world. And I'm quite surprised he said something as publicly as that.
I mean, there are various elements to Murdoch's success. Obviously, one of them is that opinion-driven news and the effect that it's had on the public realm. Just thinking specifically about how he presents sport, I mean, as expensive as it is, Sky Sports, as a thing to watch, it's just a phenomenal visual product. I mean, were there times when you at the BBC where you thought we need to learn from Sky, or did those thoughts not come into your mind at all?
Well, because I go back earlier, and I was part of the group that actually created the Premier League, so I've been involved with Sky in that time and fought them over the first contract. I think they've done a great job, Sky, on sport. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next decade. You know, now the very rich streamers are beginning to get into it. You know, it seems to me a very difficult decision for the Premier League next time around. What do you do if one of the streamers comes in and offers you twice the money? Do you abandon Sky Sport? Don't know.
It sort of happened, and I know it's in a very different position in terms of the marketplace, but that sort of top-ranked boxing has already gone to DAZN, and Sky now effectively concentrating on less big-name fighters.
Yeah.
Hard not, you know, it's not impossible that DAZN or Amazon Prime or someone else would take the Premier League.
Well, going back many years, when I was chairman of ITV Sport, I happened to be chairman at the time when we had most of those big fights, Nigel Benn, Eubank, and those amazing fights which we used to play at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night.
Jim Rosenthal.
Amazing. Jim Rosenthal. And they got massive ratings. And you'd have said, how did ITV get those? These historically would have been on the BBC, and ITV threw some money at it. And they were brilliant. Now, they don't happen on free-to-air television now.
When you think about the dream of the Premier League, I mean, I was about 10 years old when it started, and I remember the fanfare down at Forest. Obviously, Forest-Liverpool was the first live game on Sky Sports, the first live Premier League game on Sky Sports. And I just remember there being like dancers on the pitch and Bart Simpson and fireworks and things. And all that element slowly got phased out. And then the real dream of the Premier League, I guess, importing the best international talent into the country and creating a genuine Premier League. Would you have ever dreamed in 1992, when you're so crucial to its inception, that it would have ended up where it is today in 2023?
No, but as I said earlier, we also would never have ended up that most of the British football clubs would be owned by foreigners. Most of the, the only consistent factor in English football now are the fans. I'm a great believer in regulation. I'm a great believer that you can't just leave it to the people who own football clubs to decide on the future of football.
So what was the intention of the creation of the Premier League?
It was basically the five big clubs who were fed up with being told what to do by the chairman of Blackburn Rovers or the chairman of Bolton or the rest. That was basically what it was. That they did, and they wanted more of the money. Remember, you haven't got to go back that far to remember when money for football rights was divided by 92 clubs. It's not that long ago. And they wanted more. Now, but no one, as you're right, no one would have foreseen the overseas sales. You know, overseas was a bunch on the side in the old days. Yeah. Now, I mean, you know, there's more money coming from overseas than there is from Britain. You know, it's massive. And it is the international league. It's watched everywhere. I go to Uganda quite a lot. I got off a speeding ticket in Uganda because the policeman found out I used to be on the board of Manchester United, and he was a Manchester United fan, so he let me go.
Well, there you go, the power of the Premier League. But yeah. I just wonder, you know, those initial conversations where you're sat, it must have been such an exciting time to be creating this new model in English football. Was there ever a discussion about where you actually wanted it to go? Did you think, well, even about what the unintended consequences might be?
And, you know, in truth, there were different facts. I mean, around that table that set it up were the chairman or the chief executives was five clubs. And me from ITV. And we wanted it because we wanted to keep the football on ITV, which we failed to do. The clubs wanted it because they just had enough. David Dean had been kicked off the board of the Football League, as had Mr. Carter from Everton. And they were both fed up with that. They had tried it once before and it hadn't worked. The real issue, actually, oddly, was if the FA had said no, it would never have happened. They decided, those five clubs went to the FA and said, we want to start our own league. Do you support us? And the FA said, yes. But if the FA said, yes, but we want 20% of the income for lower grade football in this country, including, but particularly grassroots football, If they'd said, we want control of this league, we want a majority on the board, they'd have got it all. And they asked for nothing.
Was that just naivety on their part?
Yes, stupidity.
I mean, you know, as a Forest fan, you know, our relationship with the FA stretches back to them not giving Cluffy the job. And, you know, I wonder if every generation thinks that the FA has no idea what it's doing.
In the furore that was going on this week, somebody sent me an interview of John Motson and Clough.
That interview is brutal.
And it is, and I sat and watched it. And I met Clough a few times. I went up and tried to persuade him to come back as an ITV presenter and pundit. And I mean, it's interesting. I was talking about this last night at this game, where we were saying Nottingham Forest winning the European Cup twice is the most remarkable thing to happen in football in the last 50 years. And that was about Clough.
I totally agree. I mean, so did you try and convince him to be, because obviously he was on telly all the time.
Remember, this was in his later days.
Okay, so after he'd finished management.
No, he was still manager of Notts Forest, but it was his last. I always remember taking him to lunch, and we went to lunch in this restaurant, and he saw a kid over the other side. It was one of his, and he shouts to this kid, "Here, lad, come here." And this poor kid who had broken his leg came across from one side of the restaurant to another on crutches, and he got to our table, and Clough said to him, "Now give us a kiss." And he made this kid give him a kiss, and he said, "Oh, now you can F off." And he limped all the way back across the other side. And you thought, it's an interesting style of management. I'm not sure the rest of us would get away with that.
No, he was just a megastar. But was it because he did a lot of telly, you know, adverts and all sorts of things? Why wasn't
he was the best ever? Him and Greaves are the best ever pundits, right? Largely because they didn't care what they said. So many pundits, you know, are scared of upsetting their old friends, their old mates, all the rest, you know, because they come out of football. Clough didn't care who he upset.
So how come he didn't take your offer then?
His wife wouldn't let him.
I mean, fair enough. I mean, was this in a period where perhaps he wasn't in best
health? It was a period when he was probably drinking too much and the rest of it. But he was, He was a one-off. You never get another one like him.
No, that's true. You said earlier that LWT was actually your favourite gig.
It was, yes.
So, obviously, all these amazing jobs you've had, was that just because it was sort of the start of your career and therefore it was more exciting? Was there something specific about LWT?
Yeah, I got a job. I was with some people from LWT actually yesterday, and we were all just talking about, and for most of them, it was the best period of their life. It was, I started there as a researcher and I became the chief executive. I went away a couple of times, but I mean, that's, you know, I did TVAM and all those other things. But London Weekend was a wonderful place. It was, and in one building, you got everything on a small scale, really. So you had sport, you had ITV Sport, you had current affairs, you had features, you had drama, you had entertainment. So you had Cilla Black wandering around the place at the same time, and Michael Barrymore and all those sorts of big stars. And you all bumped into each other, you know, just everybody knew each other, really. Melvin, you know, Melvin, who is still a good mate of mine, Melvin was there. Brian Warden was there doing the Weekend World and then the Warden Show. It was just an interesting, time. And I suppose it's about where you are at a certain age in your life, isn't it?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, I just wonder now, the TV landscape in the UK is very, very different, and regional broadcasters don't exist in the same way. I mean, even regional news is not as big as it was. Do you think there is a societal and even a political implication of that? Can you trace things like Brexit back to the collapse of those
things? I think one of the challenges for the BBC, I mean, the regional press always hated the regional BBC because they thought they took away their audience, really. But the regional press has almost collapsed. I mean, there's nobody, you know, it's almost gone. It's a classic case of their advertising base all went online. There's some still doing okay, but the regional press is virtually gone. And that does mean that there's a democratic deficit in this country outside of national politics. And I think one of the jobs of the BBC should be to fulfill that. And I think you do that by in the world we now live, you can split the transmitters much more easily. And I mean, when I was Director General of the BBC, we started one new regional system out of Hull, which I did because I've been at university at York and the rest of it. You just knew what's covered. And we started one regional system out of Hull, which was incredibly successful, breaking it away so that they no longer got the news from Leeds. You know, now it seems to me that's what you should do, go around Britain and look at how do you break these up. That costs you a bit of money, but I think it's well worth it. And I think it should be one of the discussions with, you won't get it with this government, but with the next government.
And I guess some people say, is it the BBC's job to do that? Some people might say, if you save the BBC a load of money, pull them out of the regions in effect and let, you know, the private sector provide these sorts of services.
The private sector won't do it. They're not viable. It's not financially viable. That's why the BBC should do it. I mean, you look at the sales of some of the what used to be monster regional papers. They've disappeared. It's changed. Kids don't buy them. It's just a different world. When my generation go, as we are, they go, I think.
And what should the role of the BBC be in 2023 and in the next 10 years? Do you have a view of how it should position itself and the things that it should and shouldn't be doing?
Well, yes, but I wouldn't. I think we're in the middle of something and we need to see how, we don't know how the streamers end up. At the moment, some of them are making some brilliant drama, which is, we don't know whether they'll ever make any money and the rest of it. And we need to see. And so I would give it 5 years before I'd commit really on what the BBC should be doing. I do think the BBC should stay involved in entertainment and drama. But disproportionately, its function is news, and I think it should do national news, international news, but it should also do local news.
When you reflect on your own career, I mean, you're not a privileged guy from a lower middle class background. You end up having this phenomenal career. What is it that you possess, you think, that led you to end up playing leading roles in so many different areas of British life?
I got a message last week or 2 weeks ago that my maths teacher had died. And I wrote to him and said, I wrote to his kids and said, you know, what a great bloke he was, what the rest of it. And I told stories because I was useless at school. I failed almost everything. But this bloke got me through A-level maths. So I thought I'd just thank them for it. Was the only A-level I ever got was A-level pure and applied maths combined. And it was thanks to him, a grade E mine. And, you know, when I went to university years later, you know, 6 years later, I went because I'd been a journalist, and they took me because I'd been a journalist, nothing to do with academia. I had to learn, actually. I mean, when I went to university, I had to unlearn being a journalist and learn academia. And then, you know, I always remember my first essay at university was about the Industrial Revolution. I read one book, thought that's it, that would do, bang it in. And they pointed out that maybe it's a bit more difficult than that. But that's the journalistic perspective of it. Well, I've always been incredibly ambitious, and I've also been optimistic, which makes you a risk taker. So I've always prepared to take risks. And I'm always surprised if one goes wrong, really. I thought I was, whatever happened to Hutton, I thought I was fine at the BBC until that day when I wasn't. And I still do that in my life, and I still do different things. So I'm involved in things. And I'm always, when I'm the chair, I'm always pushing the chief executive to take more risks of any. But I always remember I had a finance director once, and we opened his drawer, and then it was a list, and it said things that could go wrong. And basically, it was aimed at me, saying that I didn't have a list. No, you develop a philosophy over the time, you know, of what about, and it's about how you deal with people, really.
But where does the ambition come from?
I was a third son, and I don't think my parents thought I was going to be successful, so I decided I would be.
And what did your brothers end up doing?
They're both still alive. One comes with me to football. He's 82. He comes with me to football. I think they are surprised. I mean, I had a dinner once at the BBC where I invited some of my teachers along to dinner at the BBC, and I did it just to say to them, "Yeah, look." And one of them said to me, "Do you know, on the way here, Dyke, we discussed you," because they still call you Dyke, don't they, your teacher? You know, "we discussed you, and we all decided that you were the least likely pupil to succeed at anything."
I suppose it was close to people, I guess.
Well, succeeding is about good ideas and delivering them, seems to me, you know, and you've got to try a few, and some won't work and some will work. And if you get a disproportionate number that don't work, you're out, you know, you've had it. But it's about what is the ambition of the organisation? Who have you got on side? I look back and think I've been incredible. Well, luck plays a part. I mean, I had my former chief executive at London Weekend, who I worked to, said, "Look, Greg, I'll invest in anything you do, not because I think you're that good, but you're the luckiest person I've ever met." Luck plays a big part.
But isn't luck just a word that modest people use to explain their own success?
No, I think luck is about, you've got to be prepared to take risks. You've got to be prepared to take risks. And if they come off, you do pretty well. I mean, when I was at London Weekend, it was Margaret Thatcher who decided to auction all the franchises. You know, it's a long time ago now. But the one thing that was very clear to me when I was the chief executive was that if we went in with the sort of scale of staff we had then, we would lose in the auction. Therefore, I literally got rid of a third of the staff, but I got rid of them generously. And we were lucky. We had the money and we gave it to them. Someone had advised me, look, just be generous. It doesn't matter. And that was right. Just be generous. If you, people knew that. I mean, I always remember one of the trade union leaders saying to me, he went off to be a teacher. He said, I've always wanted to be a teacher. And he went off to be a teacher, but he said, thanks for the money. He said, but you can't blame us for taking it. You lot gave it to us. And I think that was, I think ITV was pretty badly managed for a long time.
And finally, just you mentioned earlier that the likely outcome of the next general election is potentially a Labour government or some form of Labour-led government. If Keir Starmer's the next Prime Minister and things change at the top of the BBC and he picks up the phone or someone picks up the phone and says, Greg, we'd love you to come back and be chair of the BBC board, would you do it?
I think I'd be quite old by then. I'm quite old already. You know, you get old by chance, really, don't you? Suddenly you wake up one day and you discover your knee hurts or your back hurts. And that's what aging is about. Who knows? Who knows? You don't know what you'd be. Who knows? You know, I was persona non grata with the Labour Party for a long while because of the bust up over Dr. Kelly. I'm not sure my, and I'm not really politically active. I'm politically interested, but I'm not politically active with any parties now.
But not a no to being a future BBC chair.
Well, you never say no to anything because you always think. I mean, I when I hear lots of old people saying, oh, television was great when I was young, and it's not now, I always say that's complete bullshit. I suspect for a kid going into television today, this is a great time. This is a great time. And, there's a real danger of, I mean, I was pretty young to become a chief executive of an ITV company. And I used to sit around and listen to all these guys saying, oh, it was better when I was young. And I thought, this is just not right. It's just not true. So I think there's a moment when you hand over to other people. Secondly, would I be seen as a political appointment? ? Because one of the things I think you've got to do with the BBC is you've got to take... the current chairman of the BBC is getting a lot of flack, who I feel I know and quite like and quite respect. But his problem is that he got appointed by Boris Johnson. And actually, it would be far better if the chairman of the BBC was not appointed by the Prime Minister of the day.
And final question. And I realise this is the Greg Dyke equivalent of the Tebbit test. But when Brentford play Manchester United, who do you want to win?
You know, I had to be at a wedding this year on the day Brentford played Manchester United and Brentford won 4-0. And there was a bit of me. 1-0 would have been fine. 4-0. Oh, that's tough. That's tough. The great thing about supporting both clubs is that, of course, for most of my life, there was never a conflict. And then Brentford got into the Premier League. But I suppose, you know, I go to Brentford I don't go to United anymore. I go to Brentford every other week for all the home games. And I think they're remarkable. I think what has been achieved there when I was chairman of Brentford, we used to have I remember having a whip round at the board meeting to pay the wages. You know, look at it now. And we sold a lot of the shares to Matt Benhamon, who is the owner now, and he's done a brilliant job.
He has. Greg, I could talk to you for days, but that would be abusing your generosity. Thank you so much for this.
All right, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Well, there you go, Greg Dyke. I could have spoken to Greg for days on end, just about each one of his jobs, let alone all of them at the same time. In a way, there was too much to talk about. And who knows what Greg Dyke will do next? And who knows, maybe a future chair of the BBC. What an absolute pleasure that was. Don't forget, the live shows. The next one is on Monday, the 20th of March, with Channel 4's Krishnan Gurumurthy. And then Ruth Davidson, Jess Phillips, David Blunkett, Philip Hammond, and loads more to be announced. You can click on the link in the blurb to buy tickets to those shows. Please leave a 5-star written review. Share this far and wide amongst your friendship groups, WhatsApp groups, and on social media. And I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.